Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur 116. Folge von NSU Watch auf Kern und Einmischen, der Podcast über den NSU-Komplex und rechten Terror. Und auch herzlich willkommen zur 60. Folge von Vor Ort gegen Rassismus, Antisemitismus und rechte Gewalt. Das ist die Podcast-Reihe, die wir gemeinsam mit dem VBRG produzieren und die ich gemeinsam mit Heike Kleffner moderiere. Und hallo, liebe Heike, zur 60. Folge hast du ein ganz besonderes Gespräch geführt.
Ja, genau. Also herzlich willkommen auch an alle, die uns zum ersten Mal hören und ausnahmsweise in Englisch. Hi everyone, welcome to this special edition of Onsite. Also für alle, die uns schon lange hören oder die uns zum ersten Mal hören, heute gibt es eine Jubiläumsfolge mit einer ganz besonderen Speakerin. Zur Jubiläumsausgabe hatten wir die Gelegenheit, mit Cynthia Miller-Idris, die an der American University Soziologie lehrt und die vor allen Dingen aber viele von euch auch als Autorin und internationale Rechtsextremismus-Expertin kennen. Mit Cynthia hatten wir Gelegenheit, über die aktuelle Situation in den USA zu sprechen, wie sie sich Mitte Februar dargestellt hat, also Mitte Februar als Zeitpunkt des Interviews. Und natürlich geht es dabei um die Frage, sehen wir in den USA aktuell eine autoritäre oder gar faschistische Administration? Es geht auch um die Frage, welche Auswirkungen hat die staatliche Gewalt von ICE und anderen Behörden gegen rassifizierte Communities? Und um die Frage, was können wir in Deutschland angesichts der bevorstehenden Landtagswahlen in Sachsen-Anhalt und Mecklenburg-Vorpommern aus dem Widerstand und den breiten Bündnissen des Widerstands in den USA lernen. Und natürlich, denn das steht ja immer im Mittelpunkt unseres Podcasts, wie organisieren sich Menschen in diesen Zeiten gegen eine transnationale, extreme Rechte und deren Scharnierideologien wie eben Frauenhass, Rassismus und Antisemitismus. Und ihr hört dieses Gespräch auf Englisch. We have a special guest today, and that's Cynthia Miller-Idris, professor at American University and renowned author, among other things, of her new book, Man Up, The New Misogyny and the Rise of Violent Extremism. Cynthia, thank you for joining us for a special edition in this podcast, and maybe just say a few words where we're meeting you today. And yeah. What's your outlook?
Great. Thanks, Heike. Thanks for having me. I'm here in Washington, D.C., and it's a very uncertain time here in the United States. I think I'm sure that's no surprise to Germans listening. It feels like we're right on the cusp of the collapse of democracy in many ways. And I think I take a lot of hope from the fighting that's still going on, the resistance and the success of some of the resistance movements, like in Minnesota, and how well organized they were, how resilient they've been in Chicago and in Minnesota in particular. So hopefully we'll talk about that too. But it is a very, very heavy time here. And it's most of what I talk about with my colleagues and friends is the dark side of it.
There's a specific topic we've been discussing over the last year with you, and that is the connection of misogyny, gender-based violence, and white supremacy mm-hmm. that we're seeing in place in the United yeah. States. And you already mentioned Minnesota, Minneapolis. Where do you see this interconnectedness when you look yeah. at what's happening or what was happening and has been happening there with the murder of Vinnie Good and Alex Pretty, for example? But of course, that's yeah. not the only case.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing with ICE, the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, the border control and the anti-immigrant panic, sort of being the fear-mongering coming up from the administration is that it is very deeply both racist and conspiratorial, like around the Great Replacement, and misogynistic and gendered. And so what we see is, for example, there was just a reporter who criticized the press, the secretary, the press secretary in a press conference in the president's press secretary for what was happening in Minnesota. And she went on this complete rant about a handful of names of white women who have died, young white women who have died after being attacked by or were killed by undocumented immigrants. And of course, there have been a handful of very tragic cases. And it's nothing in comparison to the thousands and thousands of women who die at the hands of their partners who are citizens every day, none of whom the administration mentions or every year. I mean, but the rampant gender-based violence, the domestic violence, the rapes, sexual assaults, and murders of partners. A woman was just killed less than a mile from me in a very nice neighborhood by her partner, and her 12-year-old daughter, arm was shot as well. This is just so common and it's so frequent, and that doesn't make the administration's news, but it's, so this idea of the protection of white women becomes a really big theme. And then at the same time, the punishment of women who don't adhere to or act submissive enough. And I think the Renee Good case is a perfect example of that. Not only, a woman, but a gay woman who refused to move initially. And so after he shot her in the face, and she died, while she was dying, that ICE agent yelled, said, "fucking bitch," right? I mean, this like caught on camera saying that, and just the ultimate explanation for what he was angry at, right? It wasn't just that she was in his way, it's that it was a woman in his way who was refusing to submit to his authority. And I think, we see that kind of again and again in the protective, but also the punishment, kind of this duality, along with the underlying racist and conspiratorial ideas about immigrants.
Would you say that this is like a deeply ingrained part that's driving, or one of the driving factors for the US government policy?
Yeah, I think it's very clear. I mean, you have not only a president who has been accused of multiple sexual assaults, or says things like, "I couldn't have raped her because she's not my type or not attractive enough," right? I mean, even his dismissals are insulting, his explanations of why it couldn't be him, but then saying things like "quiet piggy" to a reporter, just without even having to think about it, like such a second nature comment, right, that comes out of his mouth. So much misogyny. And then the Secretary of Defense calling for male standards to be established in the military or even in the corporate sector. Mark Zuckerberg said, "What we really need is more masculine energy." I mean, this kind of total normalization and legitimation of the hierarchies of superiority and inferiority between men and women. And that's part of this kind of nostalgia for some sort of mythic utopian past, in which men were on top, men were automatically given more power and respect, supposedly, and women were legally kept down, right? I think when you hear things like even "Make America Great Again," that hearkening back to a prior period of time is inherently gendered and racialized. So I think, yes, I think we're in a moment where both, social media, worlds are deeply misogynistic and increasingly so. And also, not just targeting women, but targeting boys and young men with tremendous pressure to adhere to a certain aesthetic, right? Like this, there's a big social media discussion happening right now among young college students about some videos that went viral with some influencers who stopped on a campus and did some videos, and they basically were saying things like they would vote, they're not voting along political lines, but they're voting for the candidate who looks the most masculine, or what they call alpha, right? And so in that case, Gavin Newsom over JD Vance, right? So the, you know, because he's taller and he has that chiseled chin, and he, and so the, you know, this promotion of a certain kind of aesthetic for men, and at any cost, right? Surgically, you know, with what's called looks maxing, right? This kind of pressure to adhere, I think, is also affecting men. That's also the patriarchy, right? It has to do with the power that some men hold over other types of men, men who are more effeminate or don't adhere to those kinds of alpha standards. And so one of the things I try to emphasize is that, like, this isn't working out very well for men either, right? Like the loneliness epidemic, the disconnection, the deaths of despair, the, you know, that the disconnection, the disaffection, the lack of agency, all of those things, which are then weaponized online by influencers who scapegoat women and feminists and immigrants and others. So that whole dynamic is there. But so it's inherently gendered. It's misogynistic. It's gendered against women and also against certain kinds of men who don't adhere. Gay men, again, who are gay, men who don't adhere to those super masculine norms. And, you know, it's ironic because Trump himself isn't aesthetically that kind of guy, but he exudes that machismo, that crudeness that is sort of being celebrated. And I think that's how he is navigating that world in which aesthetically certain kinds of men are being promoted as the ideal.
One thing that's really striking when looking at the current, well, poly crisis in the US is the impunity with which the ICE agent or other federal government agents or are the perpetrators in the Epstein network can routinely break the law and get away even with murder. So, how would you describe this culture of impunity spilling over into everyday lives of those who are most under attack? Women, LGBTIQA, people of color, immigrants.
I think that there's sort of two things happening at once, both of which relate to kind of what fascism is. One is the undermining of truth and the separation. I mean, it's Hannah Arendt who said something like, when you get people to stop knowing the difference between true and false, like what's true and what's false, it's they can very easily stop knowing what's right and wrong. And I think, you know, I think we're seeing that here, the attacks on universities, on science, on expertise, on journalism and the media were one of the very first things the Trump administration did, right? To even in the last administration, to say there's alternative facts, right? To promote different versions of things. And then the much bigger attacks this time on DEI, on, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so, first of all, you have things like when Alex Priti was shot or Renee Good was shot, the administration immediately saying they were domestic terrorists, right? Which now the FBI has finally walked back, just like yesterday or the day before, very recently said there's no evidence they were domestic terrorists. But that damage is done because the narrative gets out there and people who believe the administration think, well, these people were the ones doing something wrong. They were not listening to authority, right? And so, one, you're already undermining the trust in the rule of law or the trust in the systems and not knowing who's right and who's wrong. If the President of the United States is telling you these people were the domestic terrorists, you have to either actively reject that, as the governor Waltz has done, or the mayor, right? And you, then you have these other elected officials who are saying the opposite. So you have to have a lot of critical media literacy and knowledge to be able to kind of decide that. And so you end up in this very divided world. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, because of that impunity, because of the lack of accountability, there's this real terror. I mean, one of the things we've been talking about is trauma, like the generational trauma that's actually happening when you look at interviews with children in school districts where parents are being taken. This idea that people can just be taken, and the way they're being taken, right? They just get taken for being black or brown. And then if it turns out they're here legally, they are released, but they are released in a state somewhere completely far away. So they're taken to Minnesota, taken to Texas, and then released in Texas. And And they have to pay for their own way back. They've lost their wages. They've lost, I mean, it's cruel. It's completely cruel and traumatizing. There's children who are missing from schools and the schools don't know where they are. I mean, the levels of uncertainty. We now have people in Minnesota hiding families in their houses, right? I mean, these are things we know from history, right? People who, you know, children are not going to school because their parents are afraid they'll get taken. And so, you know, whatever you think of immigration and immigration reform and the needs, what's happening is cruel. And that kind of the violence, but also the uncertainty and the feeling that anyone black or brown is at risk. And women also feeling, and the LGBTQ community feeling like there's no protections right now because it's not clear that facts will be believed and it's not clear that the rule of law will support what's happening. And I think that we're seeing that very clearly with the Epstein files.
When listening to you and reading your analysis, what you wrote for Mother Jones on gender narratives and white supremacy, and on Timothy Snyder's analysis, would you agree with Timothy Snyder that we see in the US what we see is indeed fascism, a
I do. I
fascist
mean,
government?
I think Timothy Snyder's analysis is right. And also I look at Jason Stanley, who has really helpfully kind of distinguished between authoritarianism and fascism, because we know it's authoritarian in its own ways, but is it fascist? Jason lays out like 10 different things, components of what fascism is, and they align very well with Timothy Snyder, who, by the way, both of them have also fled the US now for Canada, right? Timothy Snyder and Jason Stanley have taken jobs in Canada, publicly saying they do not feel they are safe doing their work here anymore, which is, you know, probably not the last ones like them. I mean, I've already met people in Germany who are on these sort of scholar at risk funding schemes now from the US. Like, I had a German research official ask me, do I feel safe doing my work? And, you know, remind me that I am eligible to apply for that. And, you know, I remember thinking when that happened about a year ago, like, we are still hosting in my department here in the US a scholar from Afghanistan. Like, we host scholars at risk, right? And now I'm regarded as a scholar at risk by another country, which is incredible. So I think when you look at Jason Snyder and I mean, Jason Stanley and Timothy Snyder, who basically, you know, Jason's book argues that there's sort of these 10 components, one of which is like the undermining of truth and the propaganda. Another is that mythic past. I mean, that's there. And then there's a section on what he calls something like sexual anxieties, which I think is what we're talking about here with the anti-gender attacks, which are very clearly a part of authoritarian regimes everywhere. I mean, we've seen it with Orban, we've seen it with, you know, basically across the world, the use of attacks on LGBTQ communities and women's rights as a mechanism of trying to suppress voter power and maintain control. And there's something in addition to that, which is really more about sexual anxieties and the anti-trans attacks. You know, it's such a tiny part of the population, and yet the campaigns that ran, you know, I mean, Trump ran on advertisements that said Kamala is for they, them. Trump is for you, right? I mean, really making this, and that's one of the other things, this us versus them thinking, right? This us versus them in which the other poses an existential threat. And we're seeing that with immigrants. We see that with trans folks. We see that with Democrats, right? And the fact that it's Democrat cities that are being attacked. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not doing this in Texas. They're not doing this in Florida. They're doing this in Minnesota. In Chicago and California and New York, I mean, Washington, D.C., they're really attacking Democratic mayors and Democratic strongholds. And so it's so partisan and so political. So I don't see how you can look at that list and say this isn't fascist already. To me, the question is, you know, it's fascist. Is it permanent? Right? I don't know. And so I'm still an optimist and thinking like it's going to swing back, but in order for it to swing back, you have to see those components disappear, the mythic hold, the propaganda, you know, the sexual anxieties, we have to see each one of those things start to reverse. And right now, we're still very much in a strengthening of those things on every dimension. I don't see any weakening.
The German media and mainstream public oftentimes equate fascism with National Socialism in Germany and the Shoah. And why do you think would that be looking in the wrong direction?
Yeah.
What should we understand about fascism?
I think it's a mistake to think that only one horrific, you know, one historical tragedy, the Shoah or the National Socialist era, like nothing, if it doesn't get to that level, it can't be fascist. I think that if we're meeting the criteria, there can be gradations of fascism, right? There can be fascism that is also genocidal, and there can be fascism that's still somehow functional. And I think that's the part that is so hard for people to understand, is that living in a fascist or an authoritarian state for most people is still pretty boring and ordinary, right? Like, I'm still going to the grocery store, right? People still take their children to school. Like, the horrific stuff that I'm talking about with immigrants, it is affecting a lot of people. And then the majority of the country is still kind of just doing their jobs, right? They're renovating their homes, they're buying new cars, they're shoveling their walks from the snow, right? And so that part of it is, that's not the case with eventually National Socialism, right? Or maybe it was for many, many, many millions of Germans, was still kind of ordinary. They could still look the other way and not see what was happening. And I think that's, you know, that's part of it, is how far down that line does it. So maybe we're in like early fascism, right? Maybe there's degree, you know, maybe there's gradations of it, maybe there's periods of time, maybe it gets worse, or maybe there's fascism. But, you know, I think when we look at what's happening in Minnesota, I was reluctant to call it state-sponsored terror, but I eventually did. I wrote a piece for Le Monde, which might be interesting to look at too, a few weeks before that piece in Mother Jones, that basically said, look, under the first Trump administration, we saw this spike in far-right violence from the fringes, right? We had, in the US, we had Charlottesville, and then attacks in Pittsburgh and El Paso and Buffalo, and all this horrific violence that came either during the Trump administration or shortly thereafter. And now we're not seeing that. Like, far-right fringe violence is quieter than it was and than it has been in the last several years, but the violence is coming from the state. So it's the administration itself that has legitimized violence and normalized it. And there were components of fascism that you could say under the first administration were there, but the propaganda that's coming out in these ICE advertisements saying we'll have our home again, right? And that's a line from a white supremacist song. Those kinds of things you just can't believe are actually real, but they are. You think this must be fake, and then you look and it's not fake. It's hard as an outsider to understand what it must be like as a German to look at that history and say, well, what's happening in the US is not that, right? And of course it's not that yet, but we are also building, you know, massive construction sites, you know, of housing to take immigrants to. And there are components of the kind of state-sponsored violence that have to be acknowledged too. And I think there can be different types of fascism. It doesn't have to be fascism is only if it ends in the final solution, right?
What should we take away as lessons from the fast unraveling of democracy in the United States when we look at Germany and the upcoming elections and the solid base of a solid block, let's put it that way, of 30%, one-third of the electorate voting for a right-wing extremist political party, a white supremacist political party. What mistakes that have been made in the US should we try to avoid?
I think that You know, I mean, I'm biased about this as a writer and as an academic, but I think that a lot of this starts with the attacks on knowledge and the attacks on expertise and the undermining of truth and the undermining of facts. And so I think that Germany already has a much stronger sort of resilience base because of its history and because of the fact that there's like Sozialkunde, even in the Berufsschulen, and then there's the Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung, and there's all these sort of ways to create a civic base of knowledge and democracy strengthening work compared to what we have here, which is a much weaker educational system, strong at the college level, but not very strong at the high school level in terms of basic literacy and basic knowledge. So you have a very uneducated population who I think is more vulnerable in the US to propaganda and to manipulation and to the undermining of the ability to discern what's true and what's not true. And so I think we have a much bigger task ahead of us of the digital media literacy. And maybe you do too, but I think your infrastructure is there. So I would say that would be the first thing I would bolster is making sure that people are ready for more propaganda, more attacks on knowledge, more labeling of things like, you know, this person's a domestic terrorist when actually they were a peaceful protester, right? Like that patently untrue things that have really undermined a narrative, or January 6th, right? Pardoning all the January 6th actors and then rewriting the historical narrative on the website and saying the Democrats were the true insurrectionists. Like, you can't believe it that that's the website. I cannot believe that's our White House website, just totally rewriting history. That is just not true. But now it's the official story from the US government of January 6th. And what's going to happen is if we get another Democrat government, that will be rewritten again. But already the damage is done because some people will believe this version, some people will believe the other. No one will know who to believe except for your partisan leader. So I think that's to me one of the biggest risks that's the most preventable, right? Which is if you can have enough consensus across political parties, including conservative parties, that basic education, the discernment of true from false, the strengthening, the respect for institutions like universities, the separation of universities from politics, you know, that I think is really and the attacks on media that we've seen here, that's a very slippery slope. Obviously, I also think like paying very close attention to the gender dimensions and the anti-LGBTQ issues, anti-trans issues, and how much that's weaponized to divide, to polarize, to undermine social cohesion and disempower people and discourage them from voting, I think is also really important. And here I have a little less praise for Germany, right? Just based on the time I've spent there and authorities I've heard sort of really dismiss things like gendered motivations or misogyny. And so, you know, we've talked about that. I think that's something that a lot of women leaders I know in Germany have fought hard. And a lot of men leaders I've heard sort of dismiss the relevance or say that doesn't, that it's not a part of the thing that we should be worried about, like incel violence, or doesn't count, you know, not seeing it the same way as I think that the country could see it. So I think that's, you know, an area where, like my country, Germany has it's a moment to recognize that if these attacks are a common part of the fascist creep. And we saw that with Orban attacking women's studies and gender studies. And we see that with women's studies here being attacked and closed down in Texas and Florida and departments right away, you know, university departments closed, curriculum being rewritten for high schools. That attack on knowledge matters and it changes the likelihood that you're going to have an inclusive democracy. So I think that that's something to bolster against.
There's been tons of literature and research done on how right-wing white supremacy narratives, be it in the US or in Germany, have been partly responsible for the success of both Trump and the AfD, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, an important public TV moderator invited the head of the AfD fraction in Bundestag with the question, is Trump a role model for Germany, right? If you listen to that, what's your response?
That's really interesting. I mean, there's a couple of different things. One, what's the role of the media in asking questions like that, in suggesting it even, right? And then I'd love to know what the answer was, because I think this is exactly what's happened, is Trump has become a playbook, and he already was using a playbook of authoritarian success models, right? Of what you do, you undermine facts, you undermine expertise, you undermine women's and LGBTQ rights, you promote propaganda, you create this nostalgia for some other past that we can get back to, right? Like, you know, you express these sexual anxieties. I mean, all the things that are like in that list of fascism. And so I think that Trump has become a role model for wannabe fascists, if you will, or wannabe authoritarians, because he has unfortunately had a lot of success, right? And in terms of, like, I don't like using the word success, but like, he has gotten what he wanted, which is back in office, and he has sweepingly erased everything from the federal government that was doing anything on the prevention of violence against women or LGBTQ issues globally, right? Dismantled USAID, dismantled the United States Institute of Peace, decimated the National Institute of Health, canceled billions of grants to researchers on anything related to gendered violence, anti-LGBTQ issues, right? Even just LGBTQ youth studies, right? Done, they're gone. So he has been successful in enacting and sweepingly an ideology that is just immediately erased so much. So yeah, I think he's a role model for others who want to promote a kind of unequal society at best, right? And so I'd be curious, but the question of what the media does in asking a question like that and even planting the idea is also problematic, right? The New York Times, I think, is one of the best examples of just constantly trying to have balance, right? They keep trying to have balance, but then quietly, like either ignorantly promoting things like, there was a story a few years ago that was like very sympathetic to this neo-Nazi they profiled that was literally called the neo-Nazi next door, right? Like making him like this sympathetic person, right? So those kinds of stories, but then also they did not include, they edited out the fucking bitch line from the video that they produced of the Rene Good shooting, like just erasure of something, you know, there was no reason to erase that. That's one of the most damning parts of that video, and they just cut it off. They're not just complacent, they're actively doing harm by framing narratives in a certain way and by excluding things from narratives that are actually from the evidence. There was no reason to cut that out of the video, except that they didn't, you know, they didn't, it didn't tell the story they wanted to tell.
What would you tell German media? What are your lessons are from the US coverage of Trump?
Yeah, I would say the coverage of Trump, and also of people like Richard Spencer, even, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, when you would see like mainstream, I think it was CNN, but it could have been another outlet, have these like debates and just put Richard Spencer, who's like a white supremacist who threw the Heil Hitler greeting like on election day 2016 in a party. And you would just see this kind of like, he's on the stage along with someone else who's debating him, like as if his opinions are just as valid as someone else. And I think that's the problem, is not all opinions should be part of a democratic society. You want a broad range of opinions, but there is a limit, right? There is an edge to, on the far left and on the far right, where you have to say, like, you know, calls for violence, calls for suppression, elimination, the lack of human rights, the dehumanization, right? There's there should be a line at which you say we're not accepting this. And it reminds me also, like, one of the things that frustrates me, and I'm not an international diplomat in any way, right? So I don't understand enough about what the alternative is, but I find it very frustrating when, for example, here in the US, the State Department will have to receive kind of like any elected official, right? Unless there's actually like a country that we don't recognize. But basically, if there's a, an AfD representative coming to the US, like, has to be received just like any other democratically elected person, right? And so when Trump is received and, given gifts by, like, you have all these meetings with other heads of state, I find it so difficult, right? Like, I understand on some level that this is the way the international system works. And I also think, like, where do we draw the line and say, we as a country, Germany, are not going to receive him? Like, where is the pressure? And I think from someone like me sitting here, a lot of Americans feel like, why is there not more pressure on the US, or not more refusal to recognize what really is clearly now an undemocratic and racist and fascist regime? And so, I felt this way when this data point came out that said something like, the vast majority, it's something like 85% of white supremacist propaganda that circulates globally in English comes from the United States, right? It starts in the United States and then it circulates globally. And I thought, if there was a country that was allowing the production and distribution of like Islamic State propaganda, right, in ways that were motivating terrorist attacks and motivating hate crimes, the world would be putting sanctions and pressure on that country to deal with that problem of the production of propaganda or censor or whatever. And I feel like the US just doesn't get that kind of pressure. And so I feel frustrated sometimes, and I think a lot of us wish there was more international pressure. And I know that's not a citizen issue, that's a state issue, right? That's like a diplomatic issue that we as ordinary people can't control. But I think there's a lot of resistance here, not as much as I would like to see. And I would love to see the same kind of thing, like celebrities who refuse to go to the White House here. I love that, when you see people standing up. And I know we're not there yet, but at some point, at what point does a country say, we're not going to receive this person, or we're not going to recognize you? And I know that has, I mean, when we say we're going to take over Greenland, when we send extrajudicial killings of people, of boats, from Venezuela, when we take over, right? Like, it's how many illegal or undemocratic things does a state have to do before other states say enough?
Especially in the face of what you described as state-sponsored terror in Minneapolis, but also in so many other cities, we've seen this incredible organizing from so many different communities or walks of lives. And what can we in Germany learn from that?
I think that that's been the real sign of hope, is especially in Minneapolis, but also in Chicago before that. What we think saw is the effects of prior organizing during the Black Lives Matter incidents, and during the, after the law enforcement, protests against law enforcement, and the organizing that really started in the last 5 or 10 years, that those networks became incredibly powerful. I mean, just very well organized, very well sustained, and effective in the end. I mean, ICE is pulling out as of, they're pulling out now, and they're pulling out because of that pressure, right? And you had a governor and a mayor who were absolutely unequivocally against what the federal government was doing and made that very clear. I mean, the mayor of Minneapolis said, get the fuck out of our city, right? Like, I mean, that's an incredible thing to hear a mayor say. And Governor Waltz described what the federal government had said as propaganda. You know, I mean, he's using words like that, that this is propaganda. These are not domestic terrorists. These are peaceful protesters. And also really describing in depth the experience of people on the ground, of being taken, of being hunted down in the streets and stopped just for their skin color and the kind of terror that that created. So I think, you know, what I'm saying is it takes leadership to continue to resist and be that voice. And it also takes like a lot of ordinary people on the ground who are ready to stand up and be in the streets consistently and keep showing those videos to the rest of the world. And so that, I think, made a big difference of people seeing what was happening, seeing, you know, and standing there and defending people, delivering groceries, providing support. I mean, there are like WhatsApp groups of hundreds of people just for individual neighborhoods saying, this family needs groceries, this family needs rides for their kids to school because the kids were born here and are legally here, but maybe the parents are more vulnerable. And so, you know, the parents can't leave the house. They're afraid. And, you know, just the networks of community support that were unbelievably, you know, just money, groceries, support, legal fees, legal support, dropping off of supplies, waters, masks, right? Hand warmers. I mean, Minnesota is cold, really, really cold, right? So hand warmers and hats for protesters to be out there. And then, you know, the fact that there were so many videos of the Rene Goode and Alex Britti shootings, that's ultimately like the video still is what enabled the narratives to change. And because what the federal government said right away that, you know, Pretty had a gun, that, I mean, he did, but he was disarmed, right? He had a legal gun and then he was disarmed and he never waved it. He had a cell phone in his hand. So, you know, he was supporting someone who was being harassed. And so I think it's really important to have video evidence, to have channels to distribute that, to have leadership that supports it, and to have all the networks of people who are supporting that, maybe who can't be in the streets, but are funding, providing money, supplies, and supporting local communities. So it really was very impressive what happened in Minnesota and also in Chicago before that. And, you know, we know this is going to come to another city, so it's not over. And I think we are looking also at the lessons from Minnesota. Every city, will we have that kind of resilience if it comes to Buffalo or to San Francisco or Seattle, like whoever's next?
I really want to thank you for your insight. And I know that you're coming to Germany soon.
Yes.
You'll be
yes.
speaking publicly. And in the show notes, we'll tell people where they can see and hear you.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Heike. It's great to be in conversation.
Wie immer haben wir euch in den Links zum Podcast weiteres Material zusammengetragen,
genau, da
mit dem
ist
ihr euch
natürlich
weiter
das Buch
zum Thema
von
informieren
Cynthia
könnt.
Miller-Idris zu erwähnen, das neue Man Up, The Rise of Violent Extremism and Misogyny. Dann gibt es ein neues Buch, was sicherlich auch total spannend ist, von Christopher Matthias, dessen Buch heißt To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Radical Right. Über antifaschistische und antirassistische Organisierungen in den USA. Und nicht zuletzt wollen wir euch natürlich auch den Taz-Talk ans Herz legen mit Cynthia Miller-Idris, mit Seda Başaryıldız und Christina Klemm, mit den beiden Anwältinnen und Nebenklagevertreterinnen. Und Cynthia Miller-Idris haben wir im November darüber gesprochen, wie eigentlich Misogynie und gewalttätiger Rassismus durch die Justiz in Deutschland und in den USA verhandelt werden.
Wir sitzen natürlich wie immer an weiteren Podcast-Folgen, unter anderem zu der Neuaufnahme des Prozesses zum gewalttätigen Angriff auf Journalisten in Fretterode 2018. und bis zu den nächsten Folgen findet ihr uns im Netz nsu-watch.info, verband-brg.de. Ihr findet uns bei Social Media unter @nsuwatch und @rechte_gewalt. Und wir freuen uns auch, wenn ihr unsere Newsletter abonniert.
Tschüss, Caro, und tschüss an alle. Passt gut auf euch auf.